Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. If you're looking to make a little money or a lot of money in the future, you might do well to study the past. How about 400 years of big ideas and startups, for example? Boo Srinivasan has written a new book. It's called Americana, A 400-Year History of American Capitalism. It's a roll through the next big thing of the past few centuries. He joins us now to talk innovation, the motivation for immigration, and the surprising adaptability of the American economic machinery. Boo, welcome to In the Moment.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
This book starts out with a very personal story of your mother using, your very educated mother, using grammar to sort of figure out how to get her kids into America. Please tell us a little bit about what you remember about coming from India and immigrating to the U.S.
Yeah, so my mother received a postdoctorate position when she was 34 years old. After years of struggling, she had a PhD in physics and, you know, was vastly underemployed in India and finally got a postdoctorate position here in Roswell Park, paying the stupendous sum of $14,000 in 1984. So she came out here, leaving my 8-year-old brother and my 4-year-old, leaving myself and my brother, my 4-year-old brother in India. And then eventually we joined her. She came back and got us. But on our passports, we didn't have visas. At that time, the mother's visa could cover the children if they were, you know, if they were stamped properly. But for her, it had said persons rather than person. And there was some ambiguity whether that actually applied to us or not. And my mother just, you know, assumed, you know, intentionally that it was going to apply to us as well. And she was able to talk our way on board in India to board the aircraft. And she was nervously awaiting the verdict when we landed here at Kennedy Airport. And that is the start of my American experience. And it certainly was economically motivated. You know, India is the largest democracy in the world, hundreds of millions of people who go to the polls. So we certainly weren't coming here allured by freedom and democracy. We weren't leaving our language, our culture, our family, our friends, everything behind for that. But we really were allured by the chance at some prosperity that had eluded us back in India.
Do you remember the tension of it? Did that transfer to you, or was it just, you know, an excitement for you as a child?
Mostly it was excitement. I mean, obviously, anytime you see your parents nervous, it certainly made a mark because it is very strongly in my memory. But I was very thrilled. You know, I didn't think I was just thrilled. I'd heard so much about America, and you know, no immigrant just decides to get up and leave one day for America. So it was a part of our family's ambition and aspirations for a long time, and we had planned, we had saved, we had sacrificed. Gone through the frustrations of not being able to come here and ultimately found an opportunity. So as far back as I could remember, you know, it was, you know, America was discussed as our final destination. So I was thrilled once I was on that aircraft. And I was also very thrilled to join my mother because I hadn't seen her for many months and I didn't know how long it was going to be. So.
And I really want to get into the book, of course, but I'm curious and sort of fascinated by this notion. With all the conversations about immigration in America today, is there a risk, do you think, for people to consider immigration as economically motivated? For people who are American citizens to consider that immigrants are coming for wealth, not democracy, which kind of does get at one of the, you know, the intersection of democracy and capitalism in your book is explored quite extensively. So what are your thoughts just about that in the context of American politics today?
Well, I think certainly there's a risk, but at the same time, it can also make us a little bit more empathetic to people that that are both, one, coming here, and two, empathetic also to people in some of these Rust Belt states. I don't think that I know that there's this, you know, this narrative that it's racism and this xenophobia, but it's also a deep economic frustration as well. I mean, many of these states voted for Barack Obama, who has a middle named Hussein. In 2008 and 2012, they didn't suddenly turn into racist. So lots of times I think that the American political story is so complicated, and I look to unravel that in this book, but it's very hard for me to just indict people that that perhaps are expressing themselves, you know, very stridently in terms of anti-immigration, and just condemn them, because I do think that there's obviously some deep economic frustration. The American dream and American prosperity is eluding them, and they do have a deep sense of insecurity, and I think it's manifesting itself in perhaps some very ugly ways and in some ugly tones. But I think that to deny that people come here for economic opportunity or are lured by that, I think it's to deny a fundamental truth. And you know, even when you take Mexicans that come over that border that are undocumented many times, you know, when they're coming here, they're leaving Mexico, which is a democracy, which is, you know, which has freedom of speech and free press. And they're coming here to live as stateless non-citizens. And to do that is obviously not a vote for democracy, because they're not going to be able to enjoy most of these democratic privileges and rights here. And they are coming here for some chance at prosperity. And prosperity is a relative thing. For some, it's a change of clothes. For others, it's a color television. For others, it's a chance at a new automobile. So, but I think that is a driving sentiment behind why people want to abandon their homes and their cultures and come here.
Let's talk about the structure of this book, looking at, you know, 400 years of capitalism and finding a narrative for that and really striking on this idea of, you know, the next big thing. Tell me how you sort of planned this out and came to that narrative structure as a successful way to tell the story of America in this way.
Well, plan this out would be to give myself vastly too much credit. So yeah. It was not planned at all, but it was accidental, as many many discoveries are. And you know, my own this started really in to some degree in an essay in my freshman history class, and I was very fortunate to take a class by the acclaimed historian Richard White, who has a tremendous book on the Gilded Age out now. And He had assigned to the class, you know, connect your own history through American history, and that was the assignment. And for me, I had 11 years to go on, so I had to get an exemption and figure out how to trace it. And ultimately, we've discovered a few economic themes. I arrived in Buffalo, the fallout of the Rust Belt in Buffalo was strong, and then my family had moved to Seattle, which is the Western migration, the great metaphor for American progress. And and we were in the midst of startups and Microsoft at that time, and my mother was at a biotech startup by that time. And so you had, so I could just sense, you know, here the old is giving way to the new. And then fast forward a few years after that, in Seattle and Silicon Valley, you had the internet boom. You had the web browser all of a sudden layered on top of the PC, layered on top of the computer, that made both the computer far more useful and had this incredible source of information that transformed so many industries. And then you see the iPhone, the smartphone launched in 2007, where you have cellular phones merged with the web browser. You know, if you didn't have the web browser, the smartphone obviously wouldn't be nearly as compelling. But people wanted that web browser on their phones because they were so used to this new thing. So then I felt, okay, going back before 1984, when does it stop? When do these transformations stop? And then that was the device. So, just curiosity.
Yeah. So we go back to the Mayflower. We go back to the Virginia Company and find the origins of America being based on venture capital. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, that's right. So, you know, the Virginia Company, obviously, it's a company. It has economic motivations, and you know, it's formed in 1607. And the financiers behind the Virginia Company, the prospectus, you can see, you know, when they're distributing these pamphlets to raise money for the Virginia Company, they're reaching out to adventurers, and they're calling them, you know, an adventurer that ventures this amount of capital will receive one share, and somebody that's willing to go to Virginia, they call them planters, will receive another share. And so they had this shareholding structure that allowed you to participate in the profits of these ventures. And ultimately, same thing with the Mayflower. You know, the Mayflower, you know, you have to ask yourself, how did these religious separatists afford to charter a giant ship in the year 1620, right? I mean, that's a significant undertaking. And then you realize, well, there's some economic motivations there as well. It's not that all of a sudden, in the middle of the night, they decided to get hold of a large ship, but they had planned it for years. They sold shares. There were complicated provisions. There was a seven-year term where the pilgrims were expected to work collectively for the venture, and then at the end of the 7 years, all of the assets of the settlement ultimately would be distributed among the shareholders on a pro rata basis. So, you know, it just you go through this, and this, by the way, this is not something that was completely difficult to find in of Plymouth Plantation. William Bradford, the long-serving governor of the Plymouth Colony, he writes, you know, in detail about the financing, about the transactions, about the management of the colony, and so much of it is about money. And it just, it's fascinating. You know, I highly recommend it to any of your viewers that want to dive into it deeper.
The book is called Americana, A 400-Year History of American Capitalism. We're talking with Boo Srinivasan. He is the author of the book. We're going to take a quick break here. Stay with us, and we'll talk more with Boo Srinivasan after that break. Stay in the moment. SDPB Radio. Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. We're talking with author Boo Srinivasan. His new book is called Americana, A 400-Year History of American Capitalism. And let's talk about the sort of gritty underbelly of some of this. And there's chapters on slavery, the oil crisis, and sort of, you know, gluttony. And where do you want to begin with that when you're doing your research? Let's talk slavery and the economic impact of capitalism, slavery, and America at that time.
Exactly. And I certainly did not want to ever gloss over the African-American experience. And I think that it's very important for Americans to know that the two large American exports, both tobacco and cotton, you know, almost 200 years, you know, obviously was the product of slavery, you know, this forced labor, you know, from all the way from the 1620s, really, to the time of the Revolution, tobacco was the strongest cash export of colonial America, and then in the early 1800s on to 1860, that they started the Civil War, cotton was the great American export. You know, no matter how industrialized we want to think of the North, really, what America sold to the world was tobacco and then cotton, And I think that's very important to know. And I think that and you can also look at slavery as, you know, these financial instruments. So these slaves were sold, they were bartered against, they were borrowed against. And you can even look at Uncle Tom's Cabin. You know, Uncle Tom ultimately gets sold because, you know, the Shelby family has loans and bad debts outstanding, and they have to sell Tom to make ends meet. And ultimately, Tom is sold, and there's notes on him. And so you can see that traced not just in fiction, but, you know, in real life, when there's this great plantation called the Butler Plantation that has to sell their slaves because the proprietor lost an enormous fortune. And the 435 slaves go to auction in 1859. You know, you're talking about less than 2 years from the start of the Civil War. And these slaves get commanding prices at auction. And it makes the South believe that, you know, based on these prices, that the slavery is worth billions of dollars, because at that price, around that time, you know, slaves were imputed. The institution of slavery was worth $3 billion to $4 billion when, you know, all the railroad track mileage in the United States was not worth nearly as much. So significant, significant things. I don't think there's any way to gloss over that in either the story of American democracy or the story of American capitalism. It's so central to, you know, the American enterprise.
I remember after September 11th, President George W. Bush coming on the television and suggesting that to not let terrorists beat us, you know, business as usual, go to Disney World, do the things that you need to do. And that was maybe one of my moments where the veil was lifted a little bit, and I really thought about the economy of America and sort of the philosophy of it moving forward. Can capitalism always move forward in that way? Is there an end game? Is there or is it cyclical?
Well, I think it's cyclical, certainly, but it's also secular, in that you have some trends that that favor one nation state versus the other. And, you know, obviously this is a 400-year history, and it doesn't necessarily look to offer suggestions to the future, but, you know, within 5 to 10 years, you're going to see China become the world's largest economy. And, you know, they're a communist country. And, of course, they practice capitalism in their own way, and with very significant profit-oriented players, of course. And so I think going forward, I think we're going to have to, this is a moment for American soul searching, certainly. I don't think that the vast majority of people in this country right now are very comfortable with capitalism, either on the right or the left. You know, traditionally, you would have people on the right are tremendously supportive of markets. But what you saw happen is a rise of populism where these Rust Belt states like Michigan and Pennsylvania and Wisconsin and Ohio turn out for a populist candidate. And that candidate is questioning some of the dogma of old Republican orthodoxy, which is free trade and whether we're going to have protectionism. And I think the fact that those things are even resonating on the right tells you that that question that you asked, which is a very important one, has not fully been decided, and we really don't know. And I think it's going to be interesting as it plays out. But I don't think that you can necessarily take anything for granted. I think mm-hmm. that it's always a work in progress. It always needs proactive thinking. It always needs common sense. And I just think it's an interesting time.
Tell me one more story of something will lighten the mood a little bit. The history of a next big thing that surprised you or helped you see our American history in a different way.
Well, I always was fascinated by the story of Andrew Carnegie. And for me, Andrew Carnegie, it's the old Mark Twain line, I'm not an American, I am the American. And I think you could say that about Andrew Carnegie. And Andrew Carnegie came here when he was 13 years old, an immigrant from Scotland. And he was attending school in Scotland. But once he's here, his family makes their way to Pittsburgh. He's immediately put to work, and he's immediately put to work in a boiler room, really, you know, running the engine for an industrial facility on the bottom of the factory. And he doesn't see daylight for months on end. And ultimately, he gets a job as a 15-year-old as a telegraph messenger boy, and ultimately that starts his rise. You know, he sees what he calls the elevating influences of pencils and paper and office work and this flurry of economic activity. And ultimately, you know, by 1901, J.P. Morgan is proclaiming him the richest man in the world and is congratulating him. And ultimately, the Carnegie Steel interests get fused into U.S. Steel. So I've always felt that that's this incredible story of potential. And sometimes we are cynical about these Horatio Alger stories, but Horatio Alger actually wrote a story called The Telegraph Boy. And in many ways, Andrew Carnegie is the telegraph boy. So.
The book is called Americana, A 400-Year History of American Capitalism. Fascinating stuff. Bhu Srinivasan, thank you so much for being with us today.
That was a great pleasure. Thank you so much.